It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A Milwaukee judge ruled last week that a 29-year-old woman accused of killing her mother with a rock is incompetent to stand trial. The judge ordered Lauren Spores to be committed for mental health treatment after reviewing a report from a psychiatrist. The tragedy followed escalating encounters with police.
Some Wisconsin mental health advocates are asking why there weren't crisis interventions before it escalated to violence and ended in a death.
We're looking at cases of civil commitment and the process to place a person with mental health issues in treatment without their consent.
And we begin with Sarah Henriksen, clinical team manager with Journey Mental Health Center's Emergency Services Unit in Dane County. She oversees crisis workers embedded with law enforcement in the county. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I do want to start with this tragedy in Milwaukee, the unknowns in the killing of Carrie Zettel last month. But what we do know is that her daughter was charged with the murder, and the daughter had multiple encounters with law enforcement. When is the state able to intervene in a crisis such as this?
Yeah, we have statutory guidelines that dictate when and how we can intervene to ensure that a person receives the psychiatric treatment that they need. However, there are a lot of limitations to that. The statutes are intentionally written to preserve people's rights to make decisions for themselves and have agency in their lives and whether they receive psychiatric care. And so, in a nutshell, the statutes are written such that up until the point that your choice to refuse psychiatric intervention causes or has the potential to cause harm to yourself or others, you have the right to refuse that care. So a lot of times we get contact from family members, loved ones, police officers, service providers, anybody in the community concerned about someone who is clearly exhibiting symptoms of mental illness, and our assessment may even determine that they would benefit from psychiatric intervention. But unless we have a substantial probability of harm to themselves or someone else, we can't compel them into the psychiatric care that we might recommend if they do not consent to receive it.
Of course, law enforcement can initiate an emergency mental health detention and send someone to be evaluated for possible involuntary hospitalization. Can other people take this action?
So there is a process whereby, through a petition to the court, a person could be committed. In Dane County, we do them pretty infrequently. And so when someone is exhibiting those behaviors that indicate that substantial probability of harm occurring, which again, I want to be clear, you don't have to wait for someone to get hurt or wait for something bad to happen, but you do have to have clearly articulable behavioral observations that indicate a substantial probability of that. So we can go forward with that with law enforcement to detain a person in the moment if those statutory guidelines for standards of dangerousness are met. And then we don't need to petition the court for a commitment, which is a lengthier process that can't be done in the moment in response to an unsafe situation or incident that's occurring.
Okay. And can you briefly explain what happens in civil commitments and what it means for families?
Sure. So again, when a person is detained for psychiatric treatment, there has to be a determination that not only is the person suffering from a mental illness that is a condition that is treatable with psychiatric intervention, also that the person is exhibiting some behavior that indicates a substantial probability of harm to themselves or others, which could be more overt in terms of somebody saying, I'm suicidal, somebody attempting to harm themselves or attempting to harm others. It can also be evidenced by impaired judgment that causes a person to be an inadvertent harm to themselves or others. In other words, they are engaging in behavior that they are not is not necessarily reflective of their intent to cause harm, but rather reflective of how their judgment is impaired by their mental illness. And then another criteria for pursuing an emergency detention or civil commitment is that the patient is not willing to voluntarily engage in an appropriate level of care to meet their needs.
I would imagine, though, civil commitments would require a lot of trust in the care team that's making decisions for a person against their wishes. What kind of protections are in place to ensure that someone is placed into an appropriate treatment environment that is right for them?
Yeah, so again, we're always looking at what is the least restrictive intervention that we can implement to address the safety concerns and the psychiatric treatment needs. And then once a person is detained, within 72 hours, they must have what's called a probable cause hearing, which is essentially where we present to the court why we believe we had probable cause to detain this person. In other words, how we justify the determination that the person has a mental illness and that the person was a substantial risk of harm to themselves or others if intervention did not occur. And the patient has an attorney who is assigned to the patient, whose job is not necessarily to advocate for what they think is best for the patient, but rather what the patient wants. So it's a way for the patient's voice to be heard and for them to advocate for their own right to refuse treatment if that's what they wish to do.
What can friends and family members do if they believe someone they know is having a severe mental health crisis?
In Dane County, I would encourage people to call our crisis unit at Journey. We have a 24-hour crisis line, and there is a 24-hour crisis line in every county in this state. And then you can discuss what you're observing, what your concerns are, and we can help folks navigate that situation in terms of deciding next steps, how to maybe respond to the person's behavior, how options for trying to coax them towards voluntary care, how to address safety concerns, and in the most acute or unsafe situations, when to call for law enforcement if needed. But that is always our last resort and something that we do pretty rarely with calls to our crisis line.
I want to turn our attention to policy. President Trump signed an executive order earlier this year, and part of that order involves expanding civil commitment. Does that order impact the work you do? What is your take?
It seems very vague to me. It seems to provide a sweeping directive to kind of, you know, detain a large swath of people for vaguely defined reasons, and then to call that mental health care. I think there are plenty of people in the community who need mental health help and are high threshold of intervening without that person's consent prevents them from getting care that could improve their lives. And I also believe that we need to have statutory limits and constitutional protections so that we don't swing the pendulum so far the other way that people are easily being committed to involuntary psychiatric treatment, which can be a huge trauma in and of itself, simply because they lack social services that they need or resources that they need to manage their lives, or because they don't have access to appropriate mental health care.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That is Sarah Henriksen, clinical team manager with Journey Mental Health Center's Emergency Services Unit in Dane County. Now for another perspective on civil commitments, we turn to Wisconsin attorney Elizabeth Rich. She focuses on cases involving mental health, and she also founded the nonprofit Andrew's Voice. It's dedicated to reforming mental health laws and treatment, and as a warning, our conversation contains mentions of suicide and medical trauma. Elizabeth Rich starts by describing her son Andrew's mental health struggles that led to a civil commitment.
Andrew was my oldest son. He was a cheerful, happy person with no history of mental illness or hospitalizations, certainly no history of violence. He did struggle with drug addiction and had a criminal record of petty crimes related primarily to that addiction. But he really, I think, was not someone that I saw as being severely mentally ill. He did develop that diagnosis after an incident on May 8th in 2017. He was detained for being naked on a golf course in Kohler and howling at the moon. He went through the legal proceedings that we have for a civil commitment and was confined at Winnebago Mental Health Institute for several months. I observed all this and initially was very supportive as a concerned mother. He had been free of drugs for quite some time, several years, so I was very pleased about his progress and concerned that he would be facing criminal charges again. So I was supportive of this system. I knew nothing about this civil commitment system. I thought, oh, that sounds helpful. So he was at the Mental Health Institute, from there to a halfway house, and from there to independent living in an apartment. He was working, he was living independently, taking care of his apartment, getting raises and promotions. And this went on for 6 months until he was, the initial commitment by law is 6 months, and then you go before the judge and you're subject to a potential recommitment for an additional 12 months. And that's what happened to Andrew. I had actually retained counsel for him because by this point I was concerned that he wasn't receiving help, that the system was not helpful, that he was being forcibly medicated with drugs that appeared to make him almost chemically lobotomized, drooling and incoherent sometimes. So he couldn't live a normal life. He couldn't laugh. He couldn't cry. And he was miserable. So I hired an attorney to represent him at that first recommitment hearing, and the judge did recommit him for another 12 months. Mm. And the same thing happened at each recommitment hearing. What happened to Andrew and what I've learned happens typically is a psychiatrist will testify as to the original behavior that caused the problem. But whether the person has made progress or is, as Andrew was, living independently, doesn't appear to matter. And to me, as an attorney, I was looking at that and thinking, well, gee, doesn't that flip the burden of proof here if the person is required to prove a negative, that despite this incident years ago, I'm now okay?
With each recommitment, what did you see in your son?
Complete and utter despondence. He expressed that at the second recommitment hearing. So now he's been on commitment for a year and a half. He's up for two and a half years. He's up for recommitment again. And he has said to the judge, I really want to know, will this ever end? Because I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do. I'm cooperating with the treatment. I'm taking medication. I'm working and living independently. What else do I need to do to get off of this commitment? And the judge said, well, just keep doing what you're doing. But he didn't see an end to it. Within 2 weeks after the judge recommitted him again for another 12 months, he was dead.
I'm so sorry. Yeah.
Thanks.
What is the difference between the rights of someone involved in the criminal justice system versus someone navigating a civil commitment?
The first difference is the burden of proof that the government has in order to prevail in a criminal proceeding versus an involuntary commitment, which is a civil proceeding. Mm-hmm. So in a criminal proceeding, the government has to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. In a civil commitment, it's clear and convincing evidence, which is a much lesser burden. So it's easier to prove. The other thing that I observed was the length of confinement can be virtually indefinite. It was never intended to be an indefinite commitment. There are some people who commit a violent crime who go through a different path. They're on a criminal path, and they're being treated for mental health conditions having committed a violent crime. That's a different path. A Chapter 51 civil commitment is supposed to be temporary. It's supposed to be for a treatable mental illness. And the idea is we provide that treatment until a person can then manage independently and get off of the commitment. But too often, I think that doesn't happen.
How high is the legal bar to force someone into mental health treatment in Wisconsin compared to other states? Do you have any comparisons?
I think our statutory scheme is among the best, actually. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin led the nation in the Alberta Lessard case in 1972. That was groundbreaking at the time to say that somebody had to be dangerous in order to commit them to a mental institution. That was new stuff, and we were the first. So we have a statutory scheme that could work, but the way it's being enforced currently in Wisconsin is, I think, too zealous. So we do, according to the most recent data that I'm aware of is from a 2019 study, and that study indicates we had that dubious distinction of being number one in the nation of committing more people under a civil commitment than any other state by a lot. So our number was 43 per thousand. Kentucky was the next contender at half that number.
You know, advocates might say, you know, civil commitment is the alternative to criminalizing mental illness. But without civil commitment, how might we prevent people with mental illness, severe mental illness, from ending up in the justice system?
That was exactly my thinking when Andrew was first arrested. I was trying to protect him from being incarcerated in jail. I didn't want him to do jail time, and I didn't want him to have more crimes on his record. I rethought that in his case, because what he was charged with was resisting an officer. The likely incarceration would have been nothing, likely probation, at most 30 days. What he wound up with was being forcibly medicated for 2.5 years. And some people don't understand what that forcible medication means. What that means is you must take the medication either oral or by injection. And if you refuse, you're tackled by four orderlies. You are put on a board and you're restrained at the wrists and ankles. They pull your pants down and they inject you in your rear end with powerful antipsychotic medications. It's horrible. It's like a rape. And that happened to Andrew multiple times.
Is there a particular piece of the civil commitment system that you really would like to see changed?
First of all, as I said, the statutory scheme itself is not terrible. I think the way it's being used is wrong. We are definitely rubber stamping recommendations that come from a physician. The judges will very often say something like, I'm not a doctor. I can't second guess the medical experts here, and the experts are recommending X. So, but if that were the statutory intent, we wouldn't need a hearing. All we would need is a doctor's report. If that's all that matters, if the judge has no say, and if this isn't, if the judiciary is not involved at all, then why are they involved? So that's a huge problem. The involuntary medication piece is, once again, it's supposed to be a separate inquiry, and it's supposed to be scrutinized to a great deal. There is a Supreme Court case, the Sell case, and that's finally in Wisconsin. It was determined by our Supreme Court that we were implementing involuntary medication orders in criminal cases in an unconstitutional manner. And that's in the process, just new laws, just as of 2024. So we're making some progress there. That's the criminal branch of mental health treatment. On the civil side, the language in the statute is identical for when involuntary medication should be authorized, but we didn't find that unconstitutional the way we're doing it, which is a rubber stamp. So the way it should be scrutinized, and it should be an individualized treatment plan, but there's no scrutiny. It's a rubber stamp right now. You fill in the blank on the form. There's no analysis. There's no individualization at all. That's a huge problem.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Wisconsin attorney Elizabeth Rich is founder and president of Andrew's Voice. It's a nonprofit seeking to reform mental health laws and treatment. Earlier, we heard from Sarah Henriksen, clinical team manager in Journey Mental Health Center's Emergency Services Unit in Dane County. If you or someone you know is experiencing a mental health crisis, call or text 988 to reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline.